The Two Stop In podcast series is inspired by the memory of the last surviving founder of the Australian Cinematographers Society, my friend, the late John Leake ACS. When he and his wife Marion retired from the film industry, they bought a little motel outside Sydney, and it became a tradition for cinematographers and other filmmakers to stop in and have relaxed conversations about the industry and the craft of cinematography. It earned the nickname of the Tea Stop Inn. This series sets out to recapture the spirit of those conversations, but this time, we're inviting you to listen in.
The Tea Stop Inn.
Mandy Walker, ACS ASC, is one of Australia's standout cinematographers, having successfully made the leap from small, low-budget independent films to the Hollywood mainstream. She joins me on the phone from her home in Los Angeles. Mandy, welcome to the Tea Stop Inn.
Thank you, Ben. Happy to be here.
I've just been kind of looking at your filmography, and what an extraordinary career.
Thank you. I know, I think I'm just about to shoot my 20th feature film.
Wow.
I just counted them.
What was the thing that initially got you interested in cinematography?
Well, when I was very young, my mother was an artist and not professional. You know, she just was doing stuff at home. And she would take me to art galleries. And then when I was in high school, my parents were really keen on taking me to see films and cinema and also a lot of foreign language movies. Then when I was also in early high school, I was really interested in still photography, and I had a little black and white darkroom in my backyard in Melbourne.
Wow.
And when I reached the age of about 14, I put two and two together. Like, I loved photography and I loved cinema, and I thought, well, why don't I be a cinematographer? And so I knew really early on that that's what I wanted to do. And I applied for film school when I was in year 12 and I didn't get in. I think I was only 17 at the time. And then I pursued a career like starting from the bottom of the camera department. In fact, I started as a runner and I was a third AD, and then I was a loader, a clapper loader on movies, worked my way up that way.
Do you feel like that gave you a good grounding, working your way up through the crew?
I'm really glad I did it that way because, one, I wasn't just learning in an academic situation, which I preferred, and also I got to learn from a lot of people that I was working with. And in particular, I started working with Ray Argall at Musical Films, camera assisting for him, and then I went on to operate for him, and then he got me to shoot his first film as a director, which was Return Home. So he was my mentor, the most important mentor that I had. And when I was an assistant, I would shoot little student films and music videos and things for myself. And that's how I taught myself how to shoot, because I actually think the most important lessons you learn are when you're actually trying to do something and work out what works and what doesn't work, and finding, you know, how to create different styles of cinematography.
One of the recurring themes with several of the people that I've spoken to on this podcast is what a wonderful thing operating is as a, mm-hmm. a craft in its own right. How do you feel about that?
Oh, I agree. And I do love operating, and I love having that connection with the actors, you know, and being close to them. And I remember thinking once, it's kind of like you're doing a dance with the actors, because they move and you react and you're getting into the same rhythm of their performance. And that's quite special, I think. I still operate on commercials and I really enjoy it, but on feature films I haven't operated on the last few, and mainly because they've been multicam, and I've found that I'm better served standing with the director in those situations and planning, you know, what we're going to do next, and being able to observe everybody at once rather than, you know, running back to the monitors and checking what everyone else has done and then getting some shot bags out of my shot, you know, stuff like that. I mean, I know a lot of DOPs continue to operate all the time, like Roger Deakins does and John Seale. And I did grow up, you know, operating on all films I did in Australia, but I think I'm preferring to work this way on a bigger movie.
I guess it allows you to keep the overview in mind all the time in an easier way,
yes.
Or more effective way, perhaps.
Yeah, and what I think is important to me is to find the right people to work with and collaborate with, and the right crew members in every department, you know, electrics and grips and then camera operators and focus pullers, and people that you can be on the same page with and understand your vision, and they're not sort of going off on their own tangent or going above your head and talking to the director about things. Like, it, we're working together on something and they have to understand what the vision is.
It is a very collaborative art form, isn't it?
Yes, that's one of the things I really enjoy about it, is that I think you get a lot with working with people rather than, I'm not the kind of person that will stand there and tell everyone what to do. I like them to offer up stuff, whether I take it on board or not. But I said, I want you to be involved creatively. Like I said, even with focus pullers, like if I want them to say to me, well, you know, I really feel that I should be pulling focus to them at this moment because dramatically this is going on. I want people to be able to think like that and not think purely technical about their work, which just includes electric, you know, gaffers and grips too. And I think that's when people get the most out of a movie, by being involved like that rather than just being told what to do like robots.
Yeah, well, you then get that collaborative result that's kind of more than the sum of its parts.
Exactly.
I guess at the end of the day, the most important of those collaborations is with the director, and you've worked with some pretty amazing directors. What's your perspective on that dynamic between the director and cinematographer?
I think that one of the best part of my job is working with the director and collaborating with them. And, I mean, I got into this job, like I said, for photography, but also for my love of cinema, which is storytelling. And I love helping with storytelling. And so when I start working with the director, the first thing I do with them is go through the script and talk about story. Like, not sit there and say, well, it'd be cool if we did this shot, blah, this and here. I start right from that moment talking about story and understanding the story and how they see the story, and not getting too technical about it until I feel I know what they want to say and how, what the emotional journey of the characters is in their mind and how they want the audience to feel at different parts of the story. And then start working on technical and reference and inspiration and offering up things, and, you know, both looking at movies together that are similar style or genre. So it's a process that I love. And so by the time you're working on the shoot, I feel like I'm very confident about what's going on in every scene. And I think when I was doing Hidden Figures and I worked with Ted Melfi, I got him to go through the script and write a slug line for every scene. And sometimes it was just one word, like defeat. And then for me, it gives me an emotional start for what he's trying to express, or, you know, a guide, an emotional guide, I suppose. And from there, when I work out what format we're shooting and offer up lenses, and because I think there's a lot of different lenses these days that are giving you a different look, especially on digital medium. And so if I know that, for instance, if you're on set and something's going awry and you planned something and it was going to be sunny, for instance, and now it's raining, I always feel like if I know what we're trying to say in that particular scene or what the character's going through, I can think of another way of expressing it rather than what we already planned. And so I suppose that I get to work on a gut reaction at that point.
Yeah, which makes a lot of sense.
Feeling.
Yeah, you've got that to draw on when you're in the heat of battle, kind of thing.
Correct, yeah. And if I know what we're saying, then I can work out a different way of expressing it than the one that we planned. There's not always one way of photographing a scene that's right.
Which is one of the interesting things about what we do, is that it is open to interpretation.
Exactly, it is. And there's always new ways of telling a story too. And that's what I, you know, get excited about when I see what other cinematographers are doing and discovering new styles or pieces of equipment, ways that they help tell story too. For instance, we just did Mulan in New Zealand with, and it was battle scenes, and we were originally going to shoot some of it in China because the film's set in China, but we shot all in New Zealand. It was about how we make the landscape of New Zealand look like China and things like that. So I spent time in China photographing a lot of the landscape and the light, and then working out what lenses we'd use and how we would approach the look of the movie to make people feel like that's where they were. So there's always something different.
So Mulan was, you used the Alexa 65?
Yes, I did.
And what was that like?
Oh, it was great. The reason we looked at that was because this film, we wanted it to be epic looking and grand. And the Alexa 65, it works great on landscape because the way it sees is like no other camera. And it has that way you can put, like on a 50 mil, you can be shooting someone 30 feet away and have the background out of focus.
Wow.
And so, yeah, use a depth of field like that. And I had lenses made for us because Nikki and I had gathered together some, you know, we looked at old Chinese art and also Chinese cinema, obviously. And, you know, we found a look that we wanted. And I've got a very good relationship with Dan Sasaki at Panavision here. Mm. And I could take images into him and say, I want it to look like this.
Wow.
And he sits there for 5 minutes and scratches his head and then says, okay. And he would build me options of lenses that would give me that look. And so we had quite a few lenses made for that film. And we shot on Sparrow 65, which are old, in fact, old lenses from Lawrence of Arabia. We had some of the original lenses from that film because they are lenses that shot those beautiful epic landscapes, and that's kind of the look we wanted for some of the movie. And then there was effects lenses that we had made for different parts of her journey in the film. But the 65 is a beautiful camera. I mean, I was really happy with the images from that.
And there's something very interesting, I think, that happens with digital cameras, particularly when you're talking about the larger sensor size like the Alexa 65, putting older lenses on there, the way that the sharpness holds on, you know, where with film, as you get into finer and finer detail, you lose contrast. You don't have the same thing happening to any great extent with digital. So I think you see things in those older lenses that maybe weren't apparent or as useful on film.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you see the opposite as well, is that if you're using like the newer lenses that were made sharper and sharper for film, you know, where Primos are actually on digital, Panavision Primos and Master Primes are very sharp on digital.
Yep.
And so you can go the other way as well, but you're right. You can see all the aberrations much more clearer, and that's why I think people are getting very creative with lenses these days, because they want a different look and they don't have, you know, Kodak film and Agfa film. And we lost the ability to manipulate stock, so it's all about finding new ways to create new looks.
Yeah, and I think in many ways we're kind of in the golden age of lens choices right now.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people are making lenses now. In fact, two people in the last 2 weeks have come up to me saying, you've got to see my new Bradford Young's made some lenses with Neil Feltham, who used to be at Arriplex in London. They've got together and made these, I can't remember what they're called now, but they've made these new series of lenses that I've, and Arrow, you're making these DNA lenses that are adjustable. Mm. And again, as I say, I've got Dan who will make lenses depending on what I want the film to look like. So he just gets old glass from everywhere around the world and also makes it himself as well, and to create these new looks. Yeah, it is. It is a new age. That's what makes our job great, I suppose. It's always evolving.
So when you were working with the Alexa 65, did you have custom LUT or LUTs that you were working with, or was it just the out-of-the-box ARRI?
No, I always make a custom LUT, and because I don't think everyone else does what I do, but I still tend to treat digital a little bit like I treated film, and that I would always, on film, I always overexpose by two-thirds to a stop, say series, especially a stop, to give myself negative, as they used to say, but basically it meant that I had all the information in the shadows. And I mean, as you're aware, like, you know, film holds highlights so well for much longer. I mean, there was some stuff I did on tracks and my meters were saying that sun is not going to be visible, it's not going to register, and the detail in the cloud is showing, you know, five stops over, and I get in the DI and it was all there.
Wow.
You know, so film surprises you like that, but then you lose stuff in the shadows quicker. Whereas on digital, one thing I don't want to do, the same on film, is I don't want to be trying to lift the exposures in post, especially if there's some reason that comes up that I hadn't planned for. Say the director says, look, I really want to see this person in the back of this shot more than anyone else. Can you lift them up? And I've shot it like they were in quite deep. Don't have that information there, you can't get it back. So I tend to make a LUT where, one, I do like it. I've got a LUT that I've been using out of eFilm that it's kind of a film emulation LUT. And I can't remember what it's called now. And I use that as a base, and then I kind of tweak the colours a little bit depending on what I'm doing or what needed, or things that are going to be, I know colours that are going to be in the frame that need to be adjusted. And then I overexpose by about two-thirds, because
And then that's built
again,
into
I
the
just want to, exactly. And I have that built in light. And then when I'm shooting, I always adjust it. And then the CBLs will go to the DI in the end, adjust on the fly too. And especially if there's a really moody scene, I will just overexpose it a little bit more. And then bring it down in the CDL. But that's me. I don't know if anyone else does that.
Yeah. I think it's great with that kind of process between the LUT and the CDL. Everyone through the post process and of course on set is seeing things the way that you're intending them to be.
Yes.
I think that's a very valuable thing in terms of making sure that everyone's on the same page, and it avoids that thing of everyone getting used to the whatever it is that they're looking at in post, in the edit particularly, where they're looking at it again and again and again, and where people can kind of get attached to that look.
I know.
And if they're getting attached to the look that you intend, then it's a very valuable thing.
Oh, absolutely, and I've had that happen to me times in the past, a long time ago. I do agree. And also I try and involve the director in that as much as possible in pre-production and on set, and say you're happy with that, because we'll do it like this, and this is what I can do if you need it later, and then they feel comfortable. You know, I'll show them how much information's there, and there's maybe the dailies are going to be dark, but the information's there if they wanted to bring it up, or part of the frame up, or someone's face or eyes.
And so you've got that solid starting point. How involved then are you in the final grade?
I'm touching wood right now as I'm building here at my table. I have never not been there for the DI. I've always sat in 100% on the DI and managed to work that into my schedule. And I think
it's pretty important.
It's very important. On Mulan now, I'm not going to be there, but what I'm doing is I'm doing 2 weeks of grading in the next few months, because the film doesn't come out till March, but the cut of it is not going to change a lot. So, I mean, basically all the footage is there. So I'm going to go and do 2 or 3 weeks here in LA before I go on my next project, and then I'll be working. I'll be in Australia, and I can go in on Saturdays, every Saturday, when the VFX is coming in or the director's saying, can we have a look at this done a different way? I'm going to be working remotely with eFilm here. So I'm setting up a situation where we have eFilm in LA will go to Australia and set up a room with a projector and a system where we're both looking exactly the same image, and we can be on a Skype or a FaceTime or whatever, or on the telephone, and the director can be in LA and I can be there, and it's Nick Caro, the director. So she can be here and I can be there, and we can tweak and adjust it by that. But I feel good now that I'm going to have at least 2 weeks here, maybe 3 weeks with the images to set up like a look book kind of thing.
It's fantastic that it's possible now to be able to do that kind of remote.
It's amazing, just for like some visual effects that were coming at the last minute. And it is incredible. It looks exactly the same. We have to be thankful that we're living in that age.
Yeah. So what sort of elements are you really looking at in the grading process? Do you tend to use much in terms of power windows and going in and dealing with different parts of the frame differently?
Again, because I came from film, and not always this is what I'm not sure if everybody works like this, but I start just working with RGB meant to be first. So I'm doing red, green, blue, and
basically like printer lights.
Correct, like printer lights. And I'll do a whole run of the film like that. And then I'll make notes of things that I want to do, you know, if I want to bring a wall down somewhere, or, you know, the director said, can we, you know, make sure that cat is visible in the background, you know, or so-and-so's dress is doing something, or, you know, can you change colour? And then, or you know, wherever comes up, then I do that after. And I'll, as we're going through, I'll tell the colorist so they can do rotoing or set up the windows beforehand, and then come and do a second pass. And then my third pass is just fixing and smoothing out all that stuff. That's basically how I work.
Do you find that because you have been involved in the DI on all of these projects, that then informs your work on set? That you can make decisions more decisively.
Absolutely. And I don't do something and say, oh, I'm going to fix that in the DI. I don't do that intentionally. I'll do it if I have to, and especially if I know it's something really easy, and I'll make a little note to myself. But I don't go around saying, oh, I'll put a shadow in there later, or, you know, I'm not going to like that, I'll do it later. I don't do that at all. I try not to, because the thing is that the more you do in camera on the day, the better the film is going to look.
And definitely.
If you're fiddling around with it too much, it can get a little bit affected, and it can start to look like it's not natural.
Yeah.
So that's something I worked out pretty quickly.
Versus just putting finishing touches on things and taking it up to the next level.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think it's also, I have that same feeling about visual effects. You know, if possible, I try and make things work in camera so that they're not having to fix stuff too, because I think that, you know, depending on who you're working with on visual effects, and some of them are great and some, I think, you know, especially if things have been done at the last minute, in my experience, can not look great. So I always have that in mind too. And it's again, that is another thing about modern filmmaking, is that my relationship with the VFX supervisor is very, very important. And I try and involve them very early on in my working about the look of the movie, and make them feel part of that, so that when they're doing their extra work, that we're not some, you know, weird look that none of us envisaged earlier on, that it's actually seamlessly working in the movie. And so also when a film's being cut and they are making visual effects, for instance, now in Mulan, they will call me up and say, oh, Andy, we're making the backgrounds for this. How do you feel, you know, we've checked with the director, and how do you feel as well? Are you happy? And that's because we have that relationship, you know, and we're all a team playing, and because it's a big part of my job now to work with them.
So that becomes another one of those key creative collaborations.
Exactly. And it starts again in pre-production. You know, it starts from very, very, I try and do it very, very early on. And I was supplying guy photos to them from China that I'd taken on my scouts, you know, saying, try and recreate the environment, my reference photos that I took myself. I was giving them to them because some of the backgrounds they have to put in, they wanted the size to be true Chinese size. So stuff like that, I think, is very important.
So the pre-production process, what's your general kind of approach to that?
Well, my pre-production now on a movie is pretty much the same amount of time as I'm shooting.
Wow.
So if we're shooting for 3 months, my pre-production is 3 months. Because one is, it, again, dealing with all these new elements of filmmaking, like the visual effects. And so, again, like I was saying, I start with the director, making sure we're all creating a visual language. Then we're collaborating with the art department, the costume department, and the makeup and hair and visual effects, as I said. And I continually checking with everybody about what their ideas are and making sure that we all have enough meetings and the director's aware of and happy with what the decisions are being made, and that they all fit into that language. And and I also do a lot of tests. I'll probably do like at least two sets of tests. One of them will be like a sort of proof of concept test for myself and the director. If we've decided that, oh, these, like for instance on Hidden Figures, we used T-series lenses that were from the 60s. Is that the right decision? So I them and make sure that it's working with what everything else that we're doing and the camera test. I don't ever really go in and like test six cameras, different cameras, and I test more lenses than anything else. I may test one or two cameras or fair film to digital, but that's about it.
I think in some ways when you get beyond one or two cameras, it can kind of get, just because there's so many variables, it can actually get very confusing and kind of muddy the waters.
I agree. Yes, you can go and get into muddy waters, and especially when you're trying to explain something to a director and they're saying, well, I can barely see the difference between that and that.
Yeah, what was the third one again?
And I don't know if you've ever seen, there's a DP, Steve Yedlin, who lives here, and he shot Star Wars and he's, you know, done a lot of amazing stuff. And he's very technical, and he did quite a few series of tests where he got different cameras and shot them all together and shot them against film and then matched them.
Yep.
And the latest one that he's done with I think it was an Arri SXP and 35mm Kodak stock, he made them look pretty much exactly the same. And he had all these algorithms for, let's take the grain out of the film a little, let's put grain into the digital, let's change the halation of the highlights here and let's decrease it in this. And it, by doing that to either one, he made an image that I reckon was 95% matching.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah, and then if you kind of get into what the Academy are doing with Aces, you know, they're trying to create a colour space that will work through from cameras, editorial, visual effects to the DI.
Yep.
And no matter what camera you've used or originally it's going to match up or what post-production equipment you're using, it's all going to have the same colour space.
Yep.
And they're not quite there yet, but they've been working on it for like 10 years.
Yeah, I think it's getting close. I've been kind of banging my head into Aces for a while now, and I think it's really it's starting to get there. And the idea of it being able to produce really an archival negative in digital form, I think, is very exciting.
Exactly. And it's been called for. Like, people are still archiving on film negative, to be safe, because the formats are changing so rapidly, and they're worried that, you know, films that were shot 20 years ago on digital are not going to have a very good original.
Yeah.
So you're right, that's a very important part of that system. I think it's almost there. I have not used it, and I looked at it for Mulan before we were shooting, and I decided not to use it because I didn't think it was quite there, but it's almost there.
Yeah, yeah. The concept of bringing all the different cameras together into the same colour space has a lot of merit. I think the idea that then they will be the same and all match automatically, I think there's too much subjectivity in that for that to actually come together the way people have perhaps been talking about it. But by getting them all into the same colour space where you can be applying the same LUT to them all, you can be applying the same workflow to all these different formats, I think that's got a lot of merit.
Especially when you're shooting, you know, a movie where you have to do action sequences and you're using, you know, Blackmagic cameras or little Sony or Canon cameras, then you know they're not going to have the same look. You could probably get them, you'll be able to get them much, much closer.
Yeah. It's an exciting area that's really just starting to kind of come to maturity. And it's taken a lot longer than I think anybody anticipated.
I agree. Like, yeah, it's been 10 years. I think they thought they'd do it in two.
Yep. And I think a lot of that just comes down to the complexity of moving images and B, the subjectivity of a lot of this stuff.
No, I agree. And I think that's why, you know, the things that we do as cinematographers don't have to be big and broad either and obvious. And you can affect an audience in very, as you say, very subtle terms emotionally. And unconsciously, are little tiny things that you do, or what lens you're on, or where the depth of field is, and how the camera's moving or not moving, and things like that. And that's just going to give us even more opportunity.
Especially when all those little things are part of a cohesive creative direction, where they all add up in the same direction and then affect the audience. And it's so powerful when they affect the audience in ways that the audience isn't conscious of.
That's always my goal. I mean, I don't want people to look at my work and think I'm just making pretty pictures, because I'm not, you know, and some pictures don't have to be pretty to tell a story as well.
And pictures can be beautiful without being pretty.
Yeah, true. That's right.
Now, you mentioned Hidden Figures, which I think was a stunningly beautiful film, but also where the visuals were very much in tune with the context and the emotional journey. How did you approach that particular film?
It was different in a sense that it's a true story for me. And I started off by doing research into the real characters and the real locations too. And I met Catherine Johnson. I went with Ted, the director, and we met Catherine. Yeah, she was 98 at the time and still sharp as a tack.
Wow.
And she had a lot of photographs that she was showing us too. So I took inspiration from that. And also we were using archival footage. So in a technical sense, I was trying to work out how we would integrate that into our photography. And we ended up shooting on 35mm negative because, one, it was something that the director had always envisioned because it was set in that time, and working with the other footage that we'd got from NASA, that was all shot on film. I mean, it was mainly on Ektachrome, Kodachrome, and it was mainly 16mm. But we had to work out kind of that, how that part of the visual language would work. And also it was a very strict colour palette. So working with the art department and the costume department on how we would interpret the personalities of the characters. And So after we knew what type of people they were, that was one of my goals too, is to show the audience the environment they worked in. And like when Katherine Johnson first went into work in the space task group, and they were all men, and they were all walking around in white shirts and black pants, and she comes in this green dress, this bright jewel-like green dress, and it was very important for us to have her stand out like a jewel, you know, in this sea of men. And she was special, as humble and sort of quietly spoken that she was. She, you know, we wanted her to stand out.
And so, what was that like going back to shooting a film on film?
The film before that I'd shot on film was Tracked with John Curran. That was, I think, one of the last pieces of negative to go through the lab in Australia, actually, which was sad. But there was reasons that we shot film on that movie as well, and it was about the look that John wanted. And again, that film comes from a true story that was documented in photographs. So although we didn't kind of use the photographs as direct reference, we felt that it was the right way to show the environment.
Yeah.
And there's always a reason. I mean, I never go into a film just saying, well, we've got to shoot this digital, we've got to shoot this film, or, you know, we use these lenses or these lights or this equipment. It has to be right for the storytelling and for what is the visual language. It's always a little bit like riding a bike, whereas I know it's deeply ingrained into me how to shoot film, but on the first few days I'm going, oh, whoa, you know. Forgot about that. The monitor is really bad and nobody can really see what we're doing, and no one's going to see what we're doing until they get the dailies. And
is there an advantage in that?
Sometimes. I mean, I find that directors that have worked with film basically tend to keep up that discipline of rolling, cutting, and everybody quiet. Like when the film's rolling, it's a very integral moment because you don't want to waste it. And on digital, you don't need to think about that so much. So the other thing was that people wouldn't crowd around the monitor so much because they had to wait. They had to just look by eye what they were doing and what their props looked like and shot and things like that and trust that.
Mm.
So because quite a few people had not shot on film or hadn't for a long time, I did really great integrated tests in my pre-production so that people could test different colours and fabric and wallpapers and paint and things like that and make sure everyone was comfortable. Because the other thing is dailies. Rushes and dailies on film are never exactly like what you see in the cinema because, well, we went telecine. You can scan them and do digital dailies like that, but we actually did it old-fashioned way and we did it on telecine machine. So I think that some people weren't used to looking at what that looked like and the limitations of that.
There's an inevitable leap of faith there required of the rest of the crew, in a sense.
Correct. Yeah, and I remember when I was learning and a couple of cinematographers had said to me that they, like you said, that they love that because they're the only ones that know what it's going to look like, really, in the end. But I also know that, you know, some directors aren't very comfortable with that, knowing that they have the option of going the other way and shooting digital, that they get an idea of exactly what it's going to look like or, you know, seeing what the camera sees, basically, because it's been changed in post-production, but seeing what the camera sees on the day.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of, I guess, trade-off either way. You know, there's positives and negatives to it.
I like that there's still the option of shooting film, though, because it does look different. And
to be able to choose that for the right projects.
Exactly, yeah. I'm glad it hasn't gone away.
Mm. Tracks, for me, was a fascinating film to watch. I guess the big thing that struck me in that film, and I've also noticed on your Instagram account, is what a big thing landscape and location seems to be for you and how you really connect with that visually. Is that something you can talk about?
Well, I always feel, especially to the Australian landscape, I feel a great affinity with the outback of Australia. I love the outback of Australia and I feel it's a very spiritual place. But for that movie, because there was hardly any dialogue, landscape and environment were very important. And so when John and I were very first, we did a lot of scouting on that movie because we wanted to find a location that wasn't necessarily exactly true to the story in terms of the progress of her journey, but expressed what was going on in her journey emotionally for her, whether it was rugged plains or desert where she nearly dies, you know. And we also would sit and go back at different times of day and work out what we would shoot in the middle of the day. And it was always like more of a scene that was showing the harshness of the environment and some of the landscape that was shown that was more beautiful. And we'd shoot at dusk was where she was connecting with her camels and her dog. And you know, you saw the beauty in that relationship. So we had very strict plan. And because we were shooting on film, we shot Anamorphic 35mm on that movie with a very small crew. And I think, you know, at first when they were talking about to me about the film, and I think the producers were thinking, oh, well, you're going to go handheld and run around with two very small digital cameras. And we said, no, you know, we want this to look the opposite, grand and beautiful, and have the most beautiful images we can. And so I had the most amazing dedicated group of people. I had five groups all together. So we had two cameras and we had crane shots and we did dolly shots in every location that were in the middle of nowhere.
Wow.
Hardly any lighting, I have to say. There was only a couple of times that we had a full-on lighting setup, and otherwise we just had bounce or nothing. And a couple of night scenes where I had sort of some old-fashioned bat strips, which are, you know, those 100-watt bulbs, bulbs on a strip of wood, and we would augment the firelight with those. And,
wow.
And I remember there was one scene that set at night where her dog runs off and is very sick, and she has to chase him. And I remember saying to John, oh, no, we're in the middle of nowhere. I said, night, John, can we make this a day scene? Because how are we going to run off with the dog in the night? And I've got no lighting. And, you know, if I did try and set something up, I would light a 20-foot radius and and a firelight. And I didn't want to do shitty moonlight that would drop off after 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And in the end, we worked out that she would have a torch and chase the dog with the torch. And when we put some bounce back on her face, and the whole thing, we used it as a really scary moment where
wow.
she can't see him properly and she doesn't know what's going on and she's scared and frightened and actually emotionally works for the scene. So it's like I always say to people, especially when you have challenges, that there's always a way of achieving it. And I don't get frightened by or scared of seeing something in a script that I've never done before, or I think, God, how the hell am I going to do that? That doesn't bother me anymore because I know there's always a way. I mean, I shot a film in Canada, which was in the British Columbia in Canada, that was in the Purcell Mountains. So we were up at 11,000 feet, and the director said, well, I want to be tracking and I want to be moving with the actors. And I said, but we've got a helicopter up here every day and we can only have 6 hours, and the helicopters are taking crew. And we worked out a way of doing it. We put crane equipment up there, took 4 days. They built a crane on there. We built these sled dollies that would go in the snow because you can't track in the snow and you can't do steadicam in 3 feet of snow.
No.
So we built these sled dollies that work with a remote head, and, you know, there's always a way of doing something, of achieving what the director wants, whether it's something difficult or just something different.
It's amazing how often limitations can actually force you to come up with something more creative.
Oh, I love it. That's one of the best parts of my job. And I think that on every movie that I'm going to be in that situation. And I am, inevitably, because I don't always pick films that are similar to what I've done before. I'm always looking at something new. And
one of those great director collaborations that I think you've clearly had is with Baz Luhrmann. And he's such a unique mm-hmm. director. What's that like working with Baz?
I love working with Baz. He is a true artist and a visionary, and he does a lot of preparation and planning for what he's going to do. So you always have a very good idea about the story he's trying to tell and the feeling he's trying to create. But when he's on set, he gets inspired and creative and spontaneous, which I love. And so you're always sort of doing what he said, but he'll say, well, how about we do this? And it's sort of gets better. And he's very enthusiastic and very collaborative with the crew, and very respectful of his crew and collaborative, and like in that way that I was saying before, so that everybody feels like they're part of the process and contributing and to helping out. And that's why I think his films are special.
I've heard from a couple of people who've known him for a very long time that he's got a particular talent for explaining his vision.
Yeah, he does. And he does, like from the very, very beginning, he and CM will make like I think it's not so much a lookbook, but a book that explains the journey of the film. And like, for instance, on Australia, there were historical pictures, there were pictures that they had put the actors into with the costumes that CM was thinking about making to create a feel, you know, an environment to show what their ideas were. But he is very great at explaining his ideas, and then, you know, he's open to suggestion, but he has the film in his head already, you know, and not all directors do that. Like, some are very different in that they'll meet me and say, well, I don't know how this should look, Mandy. What are we going to do? And then I go, okay, well, he could do this, and tell me how you're reacting to that. Does it feel right? Or some will say, well, let's do this together, and, you know, or some, but someone like Baz has a very clear idea about how he wants the movie to look very early on. And that's why a pre-production for him is, you know, just making that better.
I guess one of the other pivotal collaborations for any cinematographer is with the production designer, with a Baz Luhrmann film. That's inevitably somebody who's been on board with the project even longer than you have. What's that like?
Well, I think it's the same thing, as it's actually great because they've already been working together for a really long time beforehand, before he actually gets green lit. And so for me, it's a great experience because I already have a lot of information, and then I can go, okay, well, if we wanted to look like that, I could do this. You know, let's have a look at this. And because my job is, like you were saying, working with a production designer, a costume designer, all in different departments to make the film feel like it's in the same world. And so therefore I think that that's my job, just to enhance what's there already in the information.
I was talking to a colourist recently who was saying he'd been asked, what's the most important ingredient for a successful colour grade? He answered, great production design.
Oh, that's interesting. It is, isn't it? I mean, for me, I would say all of it. I would say it's cinematography, production design, costume design, makeup, hair is all
important. When it's all in tune.
Because if someone's coming, exactly, because if someone comes with, you know, bright green hair in a set that's meant to be all pastels, then what are you going to do?
Yeah.
So it has to be in symphony, I feel. I feel like it's, as a whole, has to work together.
So another thing I wanted to talk to you about was making that transition from low-budget Australian films and then doing some fairly big Hollywood films, for want of a better word.
Well, the first big film I did was Australia with Baz, and the movie I'd done before that, I think the last movie I'd done before that was Lantana, and it was about a $12 million film, Australian dollars. So it was a huge jump for me going from that to a $120 million film.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, one of my very first meetings with him, and this was a very important, pivotal part of my career, that he said something to me that I've never forgotten, and it was so helpful, is that he said to me, because I was just about to embark on a huge film where we were shooting gigantic sets in the big studios at Fox. We had to match what we're doing exterior to interior. We had three units going. I had five cameras on set on main unit, and I'd never done anything like that before. And he said, you are an artist. That is a very important part of your job. And he said, but an also equally important part of your job is to be a general.
Wow.
Yeah, you have to make sure that you're communicating with people, that you're collaborating with all these people, and that you're running your department and know exactly what's going on all the time, and that they're understanding what you're requesting them to do, and to be able to control that and keep it cohesive.
Wow.
And I went away and really thought about it. But the thing was, I think for me, and I've said this to other people that are doing big movies, it's just the same, but it's bigger. So I'm still doing it's like if I'm lighting a small set and a big set, I'm doing the same thing, but it's just bigger. So you have to allow time and understand how the light's going to work, of course, and I did tests and things like that. But the running of the set just means that you're a big part of your job is organising. And I still say to students too, is that you have to remember the politics of your job, because the film is behind or something's going wrong and not making a day. The three people that get pulled up to the producer are the director, the first AD, and the director of photography. That is how important the running of the set is. Those three people are responsible. So it's not just shooting, you know, running around, picking camera positions and lighting. You're responsible for time management, and keeping people working at the right speed. And then I always, then I thought, well, I've been on some big sets before and I've seen how other people can run them, and I decided that I was going to be not a person that ran around and yelled at everybody.
Mm.
I would always make sure people understood what I was saying. I never yell on set. I always listen to what people have and the issues they have, and I always make sure that they are clear in explaining what I want them to do. And then the other thing is to be thankful and grateful for people's hard work.
Yeah.
And that's the general I decided I was going to be, and I'm hoping that it works because I'm still working. But but that's what, you know, that was a big change in my career and things that I had to look at and understand.
And I believe you can be, you can have discipline on set and you can be productive and creative without being rude to people or without being mean to people. You can, and you get better work from people
Absolutely.
By doing that.
Absolutely. And I always think I want people to respect me and to feel like they're part of the filmmaking process and I'm not just there bossing them around, you know, and I listen to what they have to say and give them opportunities to be creative. And, yeah, like you said, I feel like people feel that way. They're going to give more to you. They're going to give their all. They're going to be enthusiastic and work hard. Whereas if they don't respect you and they don't feel like they're being respected, then I feel like that's like, oh, well, this is just a job and they don't give 100%.
And I think that part of that as well is looking after the well-being of the crew.
Yes.
Not wasting time during the shoot day so that you can finish in reasonable hours whenever it's possible.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And also I say to them, if you've got any issues, you must come to me, you know, and I don't want to hear people are whinging or, you know, not happy without discussing it, because I want to make things work for everybody and I want them to be happy and the way things are going, and I'm not going to mistreat you.
Yeah, I think it's a very important part of the director of photography's responsibilities.
It is. And he was, and Baz was right when he said that to me. It's a huge part of my job. And I did a panel a couple of weeks ago at the ASC, and it was all about that. You know, it was about what are the other responsibilities of your job, and it's not just running around shooting film or, you know, images. It's running a set and running a crew.
Yeah. Can we talk just briefly about your kind of trailblazing role in terms of, as a female cinematographer?
I had no idea that not many women had ever done my job when I decided that's what I was going to do. I think when I went to do work experience when I was 15 at Channel 7, and I was told that they don't have women on the camera. That was it. Well, they don't do that job. And I went, oh,
wow.
I don't want to do that then. And then I realised that there was one person I found out who'd shot a feature film in Australia, and that was Dan Kenny. And one day when I was in Sydney, I was about 18, I met up with her and talked to her about it. And I realised, though, when I was an assistant, in fact, the time when I saw it the most obviously was when I was a camera assistant, because I was treated quite badly on set and quite blatantly treated badly. And,
really?
And I was in the days before, you know, HR, and you were able to report, to call Me Too, and you're able to report these things. But I just kind of sucked it up and moved on, and, you know, would just go on to the next job and kind of work with people that didn't even think that, because I was doing my job and I was doing my job well, and there was no reason that I had to be, you know, to suffer at all in this kind of, especially verbal abuse. And then I feel like I kind of have ignored it for a lot of the time and just thought, well, I'm going to do the best job I can. If people want to work with me, they will. But I do know that I've missed out on jobs because I'm a woman. I know that that's true. And I think that it came originally just from, with a lot of jobs that are traditionally done by males, that's the tradition. And people didn't look beyond that. And men were being cinematographers, and whether it was because the camera started off heavy or whatever. But I knew that I was totally capable of doing anything that the guys could do. And there was a lot of great women still photographers. So it's not about that either, you know, or artists. I think there's been an unconscious bias a lot of the time that people wouldn't give the job to a woman. And so I've kind of, in the last few years, I've really been trying to, you know, I did an artist in I was an artist in residence at UCLA here in our periodic masterclasses, and I made a big point of trying to show the girls that were there that my job is a possibility for them and why it was a great job to do, you know. And I think that and now I'm very, very conscious of making my crew diverse in terms of male, female and, you know, people's cultural colour, whatever. I always say to people, please consider that when you're hiring, you know, whether my focus is hiring a second or whether, because that's the only way it's going to change. I'm not saying that anyone should get a job because they're male or female or because of the colour of their skin, but I don't want them to not get a job because of that.
Yeah.
And it's about how good you are, but there's people there. And we have to really be considerate of training people in those situations. In that situation.
One of the ways that I think the unconscious bias often plays out is in looking at people's CVs, because if the female or minority crew are getting less opportunities or have had less opportunities in the past, then they end up with a less impressive CV. And so if people are making decisions based on, oh, who's the more experienced, who's got the bigger credits on their CV, then that is always going to trend towards the same people. And so you have to make a very conscious decision to go, okay, well, I'm going to look beyond the obvious.
That's exactly right. And I think I've only once experienced it quite obviously here when I was working on a film for a big studio, and it was the first time they'd had a woman shooting a reasonably big, well, the medium budget film, which I called $80 million or something. And I got pulled into the office with the executives, and they said, well, are you very emotional? And, you know, how are you going to deal with... I scheduled everything, and I thought, oh, my God. I said, well, just like any other guy. I said, you can talk to anyone I work with. I said, please talk to people I work with. You know, I don't know why I'm being asked this question. But it is changing. It's changing and a big change right now. And I think, especially in Australia, I mean, all the women cinematographers, I know them all by name, and we talk to each other and support each other. In fact, I got a message from Belinda today, and she had some questions for me. So it's created a camaraderie that maybe wasn't there before. And I know all the women DPs that are in the ASC here, and we all, again, we keep in contact with each other. And, you know, it's getting better and better. And, and just hope that one day that it's the people that hire and fire that have to make the big change, you know.
Because that within the ACS, I think it's 15 now, isn't it? 15 women that have got the letters, accreditation.
I think so, yep.
So it's a very small group, really.
Oh, it's still only 5% of women in the world.
Wow.
Of cinematography women.
And in the ACS, you would have been maybe the second woman to get accreditation?
I don't remember, actually, to be honest. I think Jan was in, maybe Erica.
Right.
I can't remember, but I was one of the first few, definitely.
How did that feel when you were awarded the accreditation?
Oh, well, I thought it was great. I thought people would, you know, recognise my work. Mm. I think it also, like in those days, I wasn't consciously saying, oh, I've got to get there to make the third woman. You know, I didn't think like that.
Mm.
I just thought I want to be recognised for my work. And the other thing is, you know, I try to be involved with the ASC, and I do the same with the ASC, the ACS and the same with the ASC here, is I try and be involved so that I can help out. And I'm involved with the mentorship program here, and I take on women mentees to help them out, because I have to pass on my experience and knowledge to them about, you know, what I did and give them advice.
And that kind of, both in a practical sense, but also just in a visibility sense, that people coming up through the ranks can see, okay, well, it is possible, and, you know, there are people who have proven that.
And there's no reason why it's any different having a female DP than a male. It's the same with having, you know, a female production designer or a male production designer. Not an issue, really.
Well, on that note, Mandy, thanks for stopping in.
Oh, my pleasure, Ben. It was lovely talking with you.